From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. What are the connections between politics and character? What are the links between character and citizenship in ancient societies like the Roman Republic and in the modern American polity? The National Humanities Center recently brought together several scholars to consider some answers to those questions, and Soundings now presents an excerpt from that conversation. The speakers are Jean Yarborough, a political scientist from Loyola University in Chicago, Alvin Bernstein, who teaches classics at Cornell University, Marvin Myers and Edward Erler, both scholars at the National Humanities Center, and John Agresto, my colleague at the center.
Can we begin by asking the question, what kind of people, what kind of character were Americans supposed to have? What kind of people were Americans supposed to be in the minds of the founders of this country?
I think that the starting point for considering that question is to take their view of what kind of people they thought their fellow countrymen already were. America began in a revolutionary way and out of the creation of a constitution as an independent nation, but it began as a settlement in the early 17th century. It had a long history when Americans came to the point of breaking with the British Empire and establishing a new order of their own. It was already with a half-formed people, and it was that half-formed people that they had in mind when they addressed themselves to the question, what kind of government can we organize? What sorts of people are required for such a government? And yet there was a partly independent life that began from the first settlements and continued down to the Revolution. This was mainly expressed in local government, in municipal institutions. It was also, to some considerable degree, expressed in provincial or colonial governments insofar as they were representative bodies. And so in this sense, Americans had an experience of self-government in limited and partial ways, drawing certainly out of their English origins, but elaborating and developing their own ideas and, in effect, creating their own character out of an active and important local life of their own.
Jane?
Yes, there's another side to that, however, which is that in colonial times, freedom, I think, self-government, yes, was important, but freedom as we understand it, as individual freedom, as the freedom of the of a person not to be coerced by the society in which they live, was not a very strong element of that society. So that one of the great changes which occurs between colonial America and constitutional America is a much greater emphasis upon individual rights. And in some sense, I think that has great bearing upon the whole issue of character, because we say that it's no longer the purpose of the government, but the purpose of society or of private institutions to inculcate that character. So from the standpoint of self-government, yes, I think there's a long continuity, but on the other hand, I think there's also a radical break with our own colonial past.
Suppose you begin with the idea that politics was, A, limited, that political power was supposed to be limited, that compromise might be a perfect way of achieving results, that the nation should be formed on the basis of and aim towards some degree of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you believe that the political life should encourage, let's say, free commercialism, even competition, then you're talking about politics, for sure, but you're also talking about character and the kind of character that'll come out of a society devoted and dedicated to those ends. So maybe that's the way politics and character get together, just to give a few examples.
Politics, I think, in some ways expresses the fundamental commitments, the fundamental principles of a people, which then one sees reflected in its institutions and in the tasks that it charges those institutions to perform.
Can I go back to something sure. Bud Meyer said at the beginning? He was making a connection between the English migrations and the character of Americans. The strange thing about that is that, not to deny the obvious truth of it, but when we look at subsequent America, I don't think Americans are, or I might be wrong on this, radically different from our forebearers in what we look up to, what we're devoted to, the ideals that we hold dear. But yet we're a nation of immigrants. Did all the immigrants who came over turn themselves into Englishmen?
In one sense, yes, I think, John. The sense being that I think our fundamental institutions, as they were formed in the late 18th century, or formed consciously and deliberately and laid down as new law, that those institutions put a profound stamp on the nature of the society. That refers back to some comments previously about politics and character. I don't think of our of American society as being English in some sense in which Anglophiles might want to claim for their own glory, perhaps, a direct line of descent from Merry England. England was the transmitter of some of the great principles of liberty and law that came down to America, that were elaborated, developed, and adopted, and in some ways transformed within American society. And that transformation, as it occurred, I think, in the Revolutionary and Constitutional period, then set a framework within which American society developed, and part of that framework was its very openness to the entry of all varieties and types.
Al? I was just thinking as you spoke, though, that to the extent that the Founding Fathers modeled the Constitution after the ancient Constitution, and particularly the things that they saw when they read Polybius's description of the Roman Constitution in Cicero's Republic, that they also modeled those institutions in an effort to control the seamier sides of character. I mean, they had a very clear notion that things can go wrong, and they admired the Roman Constitution in precisely the way that the ancients themselves did. Namely, it was a series of checks and balances that was meant to insulate their constitution from the natural deterioration which comes from the natural deterioration of people over a period of time.
Ed Erler?
I think that Bud is correct when he says that the English tradition provides the immediate backdrop for American liberties in the American founding. But as Gene pointed out previously, there's something unique about the American founding, and that is the notion of natural rights, that those who wrote the Declaration of Independence, for example, were not speaking in terms of British liberties or British rights, but something that was adhered to mankind as a species. All men are created equal, for example. It's not a claim that all Americans are created to equal to all British, and so on. And with respect to the Roman Constitution, the problem that I have with seeing any kind of direct analogy to the Roman Republic is that the Roman Constitution seemed to be based upon a notion of class politics. That is to say, it was a mixed regime in a way in which the founders never envisioned the American Constitution as creating a mixed regime. For example, in Rome, separation of powers depended upon class antagonisms in society, which was not the case in the American Constitution, which depended wholly upon institutional arrangement.
No, that's absolutely right, except that what you've described is the Roman Constitution as it worked, and what they were reading was the rather false ideal of how the Roman Constitution was meant to work as seen through the eyes of its two foremost propagandists, namely Cicero. And,
I see.
But you're absolutely right that it didn't work anything like that at all. And that, in fact, the real model was not a model for our Constitution. But if you go over and read the sixth book of Polybius, where he says what a wonderfully balanced and mixed constitution it is, how everything keeps everything else in permanent equilibrium, it doesn't have very much to do with Roman reality, but I think it has a lot to do with what was in their heads when they framed our own.
I'd like to pick up on that suggestion because I think it's very important. Really, I mean the prior suggestion of the recognition in the American conception of character and politics that there were two important sides. One side was a character of a people sufficient to sustain self-government, which meant a certain elevation of character. On the other hand, a profound sense of character as full of those flaws that can be destructive of public life, of political life, that can lead to anarchy on the one extreme or tyranny on the other. And so I think in understanding the American approach to character in relation to the Constitution and the Republican political order, that it's this constant reference to the two dimensions of character that provides the necessary key. And in this sense, I think they consciously look to ancient examples, often for horrible examples, but interestingly also for the signs of the greatest hopes. That is, where in the history of mankind did you find self-government conducted in such a way as to raise the dignity of human nature? In the ancient republics. And if one were looking as an 18th century American for a source of the hope of the possibility for man, it was precisely in that ancient world. And their own classical education, delivered in 18th century fashion, was a direct line for them for an appreciation of those qualities. And yet, in terms of a conscious lesson, perhaps what they emphasized still more were the negative findings, namely that ancient republics destroyed themselves by internal conflict, that they attempted but didn't fully achieve the kind of balance that was required to check those passions in human nature, which could be destructive of the political order. And they never imagined that American character, as it was or as it might be, would be so lofty, so saint-like or philosophical, that it would free society from the necessity of creating institutions that could contain the impulses of men toward passionate actions, self-interested actions, and direct men, rather, toward realizing that part of their character which made them capable of self-government. And the constant play back and forth, I think, of that double view of human nature and human character is necessary to understanding, I think, the conception of the founding.
Yes, Bud. Yet I'm struck in what you say that somehow there's also an incredible optimism about the founders, because on the one hand, while they look at the ancients, they also turn around and say, but we can surpass them. We can do things they didn't do. We can, for example, for the first time, have a republic which is based upon the principle of commerce, which will encourage individual aggrandizement and wealth. Whereas in antiquity, the whole issue was keep the people poor, keep the republic rich. Once individual citizens in a republic become wealthy, the republic will decline. And that was the way in which almost everyone understood the decline of Rome. So this is the first time they're saying, let's found a republic on a principle which in the past always led to corruption. What will save our republic from corruption? And in addition to that, breaking ranks with the way in which character is to be inculcated, that there are not going to be those repressive measures which were always a part and parcel of the classical republican tradition.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to an excerpt of a conversation about the connections between politics and character, the links between character and citizenship. The speakers are Marvin Myers and Edward Erler, both scholars at the National Humanities Center. Jean Yarborough, a political scientist at Loyola University in Chicago. Alvin Bernstein of the Department of Classics at Cornell University, and John Agresto, my colleague at the center.
Bud Myers has talked about human dignity and human nature. What were some of the ways that the founders looked at human nature? Ed Erler?
Well, I don't think it addresses the question or speaks to the point to say that they either looked at human nature pessimistically or optimistically. I think that they thought that they were looking at it realistically in this sense, that human nature did have its elevated aspects, that there was certain good quality to human nature, and there was also a certain low quality to human nature. But that a realistic position would take those solid aspects of human nature and build a regime upon those solid and reliable aspects. And the aspect that they knew or thought was most reliable and solid from the point of view of political life or from the point of view of politics generally was this notion of self-interest. Not to ask citizens to be public regarding so much as to ask them to see their own self-interest in terms of the interest of the whole. Not to make the kind of public demands to ask citizens to be public regarding in the way, let us say, the Roman Republic asked its citizens to be public regarding, but to turn them loose on their own self-interested ambitions, but to have them calculate their own interests in terms of the interests of the whole. And this would make the Republican government solid, it would make it workable, and it would make it stable, because we wouldn't ask people to act on religious motives or high-flown moral motives or anything of that character. It would be perhaps a prosaic country. It wouldn't be heroic. It wouldn't stress honor as the crown of human nature or something like that. But it would be solid and stable and wouldn't be subject to the kinds of vicissitudes that the ancient republics were constantly subject to.
But something comes after that, and I think we certainly see in Americans a kind of heroic nature. We see in them a certain conception of honor and what's honorable. Did they really have such a conception of human nature that all they saw and all they really expected at the end were sort of selfish, let's say, use modern words, materialist consumer beings?
No, I don't think it was. They didn't see Americans as primarily materialistic, selfish human beings. They knew that, for example, there were going to be heroic people arise among the Americans, and that there would be magnanimous people among Americans, there would be altruistic people, and America would allow those aspects of human nature that we call perhaps higher aspects of human nature to flourish. But the regime itself, the day-to-day functioning of the regime, wouldn't depend upon those altruistic motives. After all, Montesquieu, the French philosopher, who was a very important source of influence for the American founders, said that honor was the principle of aristocracy. Honor is the principle of aristocracy, and aristocracies need honor as an ordinary, everyday way of life. That principle must be inculcated into the citizens simply by virtue of the fact of the kind of regime that they live in. But that's not the case with popular regimes. A kind of political virtue is the mainstay of popular regimes, republics, as the founders like to call it.
I still have a problem. I still wonder if there isn't a difference between the rhetoric and the reality. If the rhetoric seems to say we'll build on self-interest, on the competitive aspects of human nature, on the vanity of human nature, we'll build on ambition. The founders talk, the Federalist Papers, for example, talk about ambition pitted against ambition, and sure, we see a certain strain of that seems to run through American character. American character is often described as competitive, materialist, private, self-interested. And on the other hand, however, there's also that other strain, which sometimes seems even, at least to some, truer or ring truer in terms of our character, namely the generosity of Americans, not only at home, but at home and abroad. It's valor.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of being one or the other. I think that the founders knew there were a variety of different aspects to human character, that human character could express itself in a multitude of ways. And they expected that the American character would be multifaceted in precisely that way. The problem is, what do you use as the mainstay of your institutional arrangements? What do you use as the mainstay of your constitutional arrangements? And I think that the founders, their critique of ancient republicanism was that the ancient republics demanded too much in the name of public spiritedness. That is to say, they demanded too much of their citizens in the way of public regardingness, a wholehearted devotion to the public good, a disinterested view of political life, and a disinterested devotion to the public good. From the founders' point of view, that was too idealistic. It was too unrealistic. It wasn't a sober, hard-headed look at the at human nature. It's true, as the founder said, enlightened statesmen are possible. You can have rulers. You can have individuals who can devote themselves exclusively to other people's benefit. But that's a risky business. It's better to have institutional arrangements based upon some solid notion, some steady notion of a self-interested citizenry, and to allow the other aspects that you mentioned, John, flourish, but not to make the functioning of the regime depend upon those characteristics.
Al, if question for you, if the founders didn't take idealism from ancient republics, what did they take?
They modeled their institutions from them. I mean, they could have taken, for example, they could have taken a kind of a 5th century Athenian view, which I think is sort of best revealed where Socrates, in one of the Platonic dialogues, excoriates all the great Athenian statesmen from Solon through Pericles on the grounds that none of them made the citizens better. But they weren't looking, they didn't model those institutions after Athenian democratic institutions. They modeled them after Roman republican institutions. And the crucial question there is, how do you let people make their wishes known? In Athens, you let them speak. In Rome, you never let them speak. The first thing you do is you make sure that there are no seats in any of the Roman voting assemblies so that they don't stay there very long. But the second thing, of course, that you do is you have all debate going on amongst the patres in the Senate itself. This is the only medium for exchange. And incidentally, when the Romans speak of character, they're always speaking of the character of the ruling classes. They're never speaking of the character of the peasantry, which makes up 95% of the population. So again, the Romans would deal with this by acknowledging that people had a right to express an opinion. Primarily on whether we're going to go to war or not, and who the candidate should be that year. But they could only do it by walking out of their pens, and literally pens where they were penned up, by walking out of their pens and placing a ballot in the appropriate box. Never got a chance to say anything. I suspect that the ancients had a much more inflexible, rigid notion of character than certainly what we have today, and I suspect what the founding fathers did. In other words, I think character was not seen as infinitely malleable in antiquity. I don't think it was seen as even being very malleable at all. It was largely the product of birth, you know, having the proper genes, and then from a very, very early period to not very late in your life of being molded to the extent that it could be molded by following the exemplary paternal virtue of the immediate and the extended family. So there would not really have properly been, I think, I'd like to confine this to Republican Rome, there really wouldn't have been a notion that the state had a great mission to mold character, because there wouldn't have been that notion that there was a lot of character molding that could in fact go on.
Bud mentioned earlier that the founders were building on the kind of people that were already here, and I think that he was absolutely right about that. It was a vigorous people, one that was well instituted, not only by its English heritage, British heritage, but by the situation that it found itself in colonial America. It was a people well suited for liberty. And I think that what the founders wanted to do more than anything else was to establish a regime that would build upon that character, but to establish a regime that didn't depend upon inculcating a certain kind of additional character traits in the people. That is to say, a regime whose institutions would not depend directly upon the inculcation of any certain kind of character, but would build upon a vigorous, aggressive, freedom-loving people. The ancient republics, as Al mentioned, depended upon character or depend upon a certain notion of character more than the American founders believed it was necessary in a popular form of government. I believe that they wanted to leave character development primarily to private institutions. The public character of the regime would be, insofar as it was possible, to be indifferent to the necessity of having to inculcate any specific kind of character, or indifferent to being moralistic in Jean's term.
How aware of themselves as founders were the founders?
They were very aware of themselves as founders, and I relied principally on Douglas Adair's work for that, Fame in the Founding Fathers, where he tells us that George Washington had busts of all the great Romans in his garden, Alexander Hamilton.
And this wasn't merely just the thing to do.
He traces from the outset of the early revolutionary period up to the time when the fighting actually commenced and the founding of the Constitution began, this gradual heightening of the ambitions of the leaders of American leaders. And you see this escalation in their expectations and their own personal ambitions. Another example is Alexander Hamilton, who kept something called a paybook in which he recorded the most mundane issues. And in little sections of that, he has excerpts from Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus. And he was concentrating on all these founders and obviously, evidently identifying with them. So I think in that sense, everyone with the exception of Jefferson, who was, I think, more the scientist, who saw himself and who saw science as possibly the greater benefactor of mankind rather than politics. Every one of the other more political founders, political in that sense, that Jefferson was more cosmopolitan, more universal, I think, in his thinking, but all the others, to a very large extent, I think, identified with the great founders of antiquity and saw themselves cast somewhat in that role.
Bud Myers, did you have a comment?
Well, I was going to support Jean's position with humble material, namely the fact that these gentlemen didn't let a scrap of paper die or disappear. It bespoke, I think, first a certain extraordinary pride that even their worst thoughts, so to speak, could bear the light of history, even if they might not bear the light of day at that moment, seen by the wrong people. And I would add an even more literal example. How do we know about that most important event of founding, the Philadelphia Convention? Because one James Madison of Virginia, a man already of some distinction in his society, elected himself to the humble role of clerk. At the beginning of the convention, he took a seat in front before the presiding officer and sat there and recorded the debates. And he did so faithfully, day in, day out. One hardly knows when he relieved himself, and preserved those papers, interestingly kept them confidential, and yet provided in his will for their publication.
Maybe that accounts for his stern disposition.
Hamilton actually says in print at one point that ambition is the ruling passion of the noblest minds.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for Soundings. What are some of the connections between politics and character? What are the links between character and citizenship in ancient societies such as the Roman Republic and in modern governments such as American constitutional democracy? Soundings explores those questions this week in the first part of a special series on politics and the American character. Two scholars at the National Humanities Center, specializing in political history and philosophy, and two visitors from Loyola and Cornell Universities will provide insights and answers. Join me the week of July 4th for Politics and the American Character on Soundings.